Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello, Joe Devine.
And JJ Bull the Bullet. Hi, JJ.
Hello, Joe.
How's it going?
Good. We've been here all day.
We've been here all day. But it was a good day to be here, all of, because there were three games, and actually we went out for one of them, didn't we? We had a fun time earlier. That was nice. Lots to get through today. Of course, England-Iran was the first game of the day. We just watched USA-Wales, so we'll be talking about that too. And Netherlands-Senegal, that was the game that we skipped out of the office for most of. So that was fun. Bit of a different, little bit of different scenery. And of course, a return of Points Are Bad, where I don't want to give any spoilers away, but I'm happier today than I was yesterday.
Yeah. It's a big spoiler, really, isn't it?
Yes, it is a big spoiler. Yeah. But I just said I didn't want to give any away. Not that I wouldn't. But listen, if you wouldn't want to give any away,
if you want spoilers,
that's so much better.
That
isn't
is pretty
it?
Good.
If you want spoilers for football, not for football games, but if you want spoilers for sort of football news, where you would ordinarily wait around in your home in the day and think, I'll find out about that news later, but you could find out about it earlier, it turned out not to be much better as I thought. You should visit The Athletic. TheAthletic.com/TIFO. TheAthletic.com/TIFO, where you, I think there's a very special deal on at the moment. I believe you can get The Athletic for £1 a month for 6 months if you visit that link, which is very exciting, isn't it? And there's been an extraordinary number. I mean, in jest in these parts most of the time, but I have to say, I'm floored by the quality of the pieces that have been released World Cup related so far. And we're only on day two. So, you know, there's plenty more to come. Check it out. That's TheAthletic.com/TIFO. But for now, of course, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of, you know, not as many people in stadiums as you would want. Okay, beginning with England 6 to Iran. We'll get to the football shortly, but there are a couple of other issues to discuss first. And Seb, I'm going to start with you because I think in what was for me maybe the most moving moment of the World Cup game so far, the Iranian players did not sing the national anthem. And I just wanted to ask you why that is significant.
Right, so the full context for this is best found in a James Montague article, which is published this morning by The Athletic. And crux of it is that it's been a controversy after the death of an Iranian woman in custody earlier in the year. There's been protests in Tehran. There's been brutality. There's been deaths. There's been further arrests. And one of the issues which has arisen is the kind of the allyship and the support of Iranian celebrities, including professional footballers, who some of the pressure groups, there's a group called Open Stadiums, which lobbies for the rights of women in domestic Iranian football stadiums, right, to actually go. And they're among a series of groups who believe that a lot of the Iranian players haven't provided the support or haven't shown as much empathy as they'd hoped for, with a few exceptions. Sardar Azmoun, of course, made a very definitive Instagram post, and so much so that he was actually, there was some suggestion he might miss the tournament. But one of the lines...
He missed today's game through injury, I think.
Yeah, he's part of the squad. He was selected. Yeah. So one of the lines also was that a lot of the people that wanted empathy or who were seeking reassurance or allyship from players, they said prior to the tournament that if the players were seen to sing the anthem, then that would represent a kind of, I suppose, a deferential attitude or a rejection of, or a failure to be sympathetic enough to the domestic situation in Iran.
An embracing of the status quo, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. And so what you had is this incredibly moving moment where everybody knows that for a lot of the players in Iran, being defiant in any way whatsoever is quite dangerous, not necessarily for them, but for their families, even for players who earn their living abroad. And so you had this very moving situation where not a single one of them sang the anthem. And at various times, the camera cuts to Iranian supporters in the crowd who were visibly moved by that.
Yeah.
It's a very touching moment. There's a report in The Athletic shortly after, which revealed that actually Iranian state TV had cut away from that and had censored the image of those players not singing the anthem and then shown instead pockets of fans back home who were seen celebrating and, you know, eagerly anticipating the game against England, which was probably not a fair reflection of what was happening in the stadium. Mm. So it's very moving because it's very brave.
It's extremely brave.
It's very hard for us to put ourselves in that situation. It's very easy for us to say, well, of course you shouldn't sing the anthem and you should show solidarity with the victims of the abuses and the human rights offences which are occurring in Iran. Much harder to actually do it, to be in that situation and to be under that spotlight. I'm full of admiration for it. It was
No, so was I. Do you know, as I said at the beginning in my question, I think it was, you know, it felt like an extremely moving moment to observe. And also it certainly, you know, it took away some of my gusto as an England fan as well. It sort of felt, you know, when the game began, like, what? Do I really want England to beat this team?
I'm sure we're going to talk about this a little bit later, but this was juxtaposed with the controversy around the armband. We know we're going to talk about that in more detail afterwards.
Yeah.
But you had that and then the game started and then you had, this is going to sound a little bit trite, but one of the moments of the tournament, and I don't mean to trivialize it. It just was. It's like when a World Cup ends, you think of moments of significance, whether it be in 2014, the Brazilian players singing their anthem a cappella, those kind of things. And those are your takeaways. And I think whatever else happens during the rest of this tournament, that will be one of them. The camera panning along the line of Iranian players and to a man rejecting the anthem. I very difficult for us to process because we can never be in that situation. But yeah, it was extraordinarily moving.
Okay. Well, it's worth pointing out that James Montague has written a piece for The Athletic about this, and we are converting most of it into a video, which releases, I think, next Monday. Is that right, Seb?
Yeah. So we do read the full article because, as always with James Montague, it's wonderfully well done and brilliantly researched. And we will be releasing a video version, Monday morning, the 28th.
So there's lots more context in that.
Absolutely.
Which was very, very useful because until I read that, I had much less of an idea of what was happening.
Yeah, no one better than James to tell those kind of stories and to actually paint the picture of what led everybody to that point in history.
Yeah.
It's a very, very good piece of writing.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, listen, from England's perspective, before the game, the discussion mostly revolved around the One Love armband and how Harry Kane was no longer wearing it as he would incur a yellow card for doing so at the beginning of the game. So earlier on, I spoke to Alex Kajelski, who is the Athletic UK's editor-in-chief. And I started by asking him what the issue is, so we can hear from him now.
Well, because as of this morning, a bunch of countries, including England, Germany, Netherlands, Wales, and some others, decided to backtrack on a decision to wear something they called the One Love armband, which was supposed to be anti-discrimination, a sign of defiance against a World Cup in Qatar. And under pressure from FIFA, they say, they and now decided not to wear it after making a very, very big fanfare for a couple of months about how they were going to. I guess they would say that all of a sudden they felt they were going to be under sporting sanctions, they say, which means potentially a yellow card for the captain who could wear it. So if Harry Kane came out onto the field with this dangerous armband on, then he could get booked, which obviously puts him in a very difficult position. Virgil van Dijk, who's the Netherlands captain, said he would feel uncomfortable playing centre-back on a yellow card from the beginning of a game, for example. No one knows whether FIFA were actually going to follow through with that or not, but the countries decided that was too much of a risk and that their gesture had to be withdrawn.
Is anyone blame-free in this situation?
Probably some of the players. I mean, I think everyone looks bad in this. I mean, here's FIFA basically trying to stop a bunch of countries promoting anti-discrimination. That's not a great look because they want to people to wear their own armbands, which they announced a couple of days ago that come in all these various formats. You've got the countries themselves who wanted to claim they were making a stand, but the second it became a little bit dangerous to get a yellow card, have all backed out. And if you think of the things that footballers are willing to do sometimes to get yellow cards, like dive or time waste or take their shirt off when they score a goal, like, this doesn't feel that great. Plus, if they'd have just got to the bottom of the rules in the first place and got clarity rather than on the morning of the game, we wouldn't be in this mess. So I think the federations look weak and like they don't really back LGBT plus fans. FIFA look like FIFA. And then there's just a bunch of players who, you know, probably do have some opinions, but are being told not to have them.
Now, this was going to be a difficult tournament for LGBT plus fans anyway. How do you think this makes them feel?
Pretty deflated, I do. I've wrestled with the whole tournament, as many of us have, for lots of reasons. I do think that it's not that difficult for, say, the manager of a national team to say, we are in Qatar. It is very sad that LGBT plus people have to live this way and are treated this way in this country, and then get on with it. I think this sort of scrabbling around to try and come up with an armband that, by the way, didn't actually say it was pro-LGBT plus, it just sort of said it was called One Love and didn't want to say the actual words, just ended up being incredibly messy and made LGBT plus people largely feel very unsupported anyway. And then to add insult to injury, they're not even doing that. So I would say, if I'm allowed to swear, a bit of a show.
Thanks to Alex Kajalski for that from earlier on. That was much appreciated for him to take the time. What's really interesting about doing these live, by the way, as I put my headphones on the floor, like a live professional, is that we get to read the comments. And I was reading the comments as I was listening to Alex there. There's a kind of division. And I would hate to suggest that there are equal numbers of people on either side, because I don't think that's true. I think there's a kind of loud minority in this case of people who seem to think it's possible in the slightest to leave politics out of football. It's an absolutely ridiculous thing to suggest that people do. And I would really encourage you to try to educate yourself to understand why that's not possible. If you're unhappy with us discussing these things, you're very welcome to go and listen to another football podcast, because this is what we do here. This is always what we've done at TIFO, and I think it's impossible to treat it any differently. As it happens, we're going to discuss the football now, but not because you said to. Yeah, because that's what it says on the plan that someone wrote for me.
Very well said. I mean, not the bit about like, you know, not because you told us to, but the bit before that was very well said.
Yeah.
Now
people are cheering me. Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel emboldened.
You're getting hearts and emojis. Everybody loves Joe.
Well, that's why I said. That's why I said it's a vocal minority. Anyway, let's discuss the football. Thanks to Alex Kajalski.
That was very interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, it is interesting. I think it really is interesting. And it's good to get someone who knows what they're talking about. But let's discuss England 6, JJ, 2 Iran.
Yes.
Are England good?
Yes.
make him say it again.
Before the tournament, I really thought this would be a game that they struggle to score goals in. And the reason for it is the way that Iran play and what I tend to see England struggling with. And we did a video on this on TIFO IRL today, which is, what day is today? Monday, which came out after the game, looking at what the differences are between the back three that Southgate would play. If you're watching this on the internet, then not listen to the podcast, and you can see me playing with a tactics board. But the difference that it makes between having a back three and a back four, and why the back four means that you can get more players in higher positions up the pitch, including Jude Bellingham. But Iran, very much came out with this 5-4-1, shut everything down, a real block. So everything had to go around this block always.
Mm.
So they'd go side to side. They go, you know, they'd be shifted from side to side. So England had to, the only space they'd really get would be in wide areas. But generally when teams do that, it limits space between lines, so you can't then thread anything through.
Yeah.
You just
and we joked
through.
At the beginning of the game about the idea that England were just going to kind of pass it side to side for a long time and not really get around them, right?
Yeah. And so that's the thing. And then, but that's what they kind of do. England use possession as a form of defence almost. So they take the lead and they pass it around a lot. So if you have all your players in four positions and you get them into, you know, the other team's half and you push them right forward, it just allows you to be able to circulate the ball and keep it. And while you do that, it forces them out a bit to try and get up the pitch. And as they start coming forward, sure enough, space is then created between lines. It is created further up the pitch. And then you can suddenly start threading passes through. But I thought England was just excellent at all phases of play. So they were really good, well, not defensively actually, but what they were really good at doing was keeping the ball. The first goal they scored was from an open play cross into the box. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, the difference between the back three and the back four, what we saw in this goal is that when they tend to attack, sure enough, you get wing backs forward, whichever system you're playing. You always get them nice and wide. Then your inside forwards join in the middle. And you get Kane and you get another forward. So you tend to have five. You have a row of five, mostly across the front. And that's not different for a lot of teams. They end up with a 2-3-5 looking shape. That's what most teams do. But because you have this, then you've got Bellingham joining in. You don't have another centre-back who's staying deeper. You have someone further up the pitch. They can join in to get in on the action. Then the action comes in the box and the action scores the goal. And that's one of the big benefits of having the action.
part of what JJ's describing, Seb, was enabled by Jude Bellingham, who did not play in the Euros last year.
No.
Having him in the team, and this is not a criticism of Calvin Phillips, but instead of Calvin Phillips, it gives the team quite a different complexion, doesn't it?
Very different player. I mean, Jude Bellingham, I think that would have been a bit too early for him 18 months ago. I think the great advantage of him is that he's happy receiving possession anywhere, whether that be off his defenders or goalkeeper, from another midfielder. I think also, in many ways, and it's going to sound a little bit like hyperbole, he's kind of the perfect midfielder because he's so versatile. He does so many different things well, whether that be recycling possession, creating chances, advancing play out the pitch. Also, he's a goal scorer. And one of the things that's emerged this season is he scores artful goals. He scores goals that get a lot of... draw a lot of notice on social media. But he's a scorer of scrappy goals too. He's an opportunistic scorer of goals. I feel like we talked about this a little bit earlier, but growing up, Jude Bellingham idolized Steven Gerrard. I felt like today's goal, the first goal against Iran, was a very Steven Gerrard-like goal. It wasn't one of those kind of rasping 30-yarders, one of those headers where finds some space between defenders. It's actually a really good header as well. It's not just a kind of, it's not a simple conversion. It's actually a shaped header into the far corner. And I think that kind of describes just how many facets there are to his game. Because I think most people are aware of the Jude Bellingham who can beat players. He scored that very, very good goal in the Bundesliga last year. I mean, when he sort of, I think it was against Stuttgart, might be wrong about that, but he kind of pirouetted through the defense and sort of lifted the ball over the goalkeeper. But also he scores the kind of, let's call it the Gerard Lampard type of goal, which is this is what you are as an attacking midfielder, an attacking goal scoring midfielder. This is where you score goals in the box, not just the kind of the crowd pleasers. And it kind of described just how good a player he is and also why he's going to be so valuable in the future.
I think tactically he's maybe not better than Gerrard, but he's very different.
I was going to ask, how is he different from Gerrard?
Well, I think Gerrard's a lot about energy and dynamism and making things happen and taking games by the scruff of the neck, all the kind of cliches, because he's very much Captain England or Captain Liverpool. That's what Gerrard does.
I always think about that. Maybe it was his last season or just before that, when he came on at half time for Liverpool against Manchester United and he fell down to Herrera in 43 seconds and got sent off. Do you remember?
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of that still in Bellingham. So if there's a problem in his career at the moment, is that he's playing for a Dortmund side who don't have quite enough definition. They're not quite structured enough. And as a result, in games where things don't go quite as they need to, Bellingham has a tendency to try and do a little bit too much. He has that kind of, it's hero ball. And Gerrard used to be...
that's a really good word.
Yeah, but he used to be susceptible to that. And I understand that because he was often the most talented player and the most influential player on the side. And Bellingham has a similar role in Dortmund. And so sometimes you can see him trying to play almost two or three midfield roles within the same 90 minutes. And the cost of that perhaps is like the concentration of his effect in specific areas, whether it be, you know, attacking or defensive support or whatever the case may be. So there's still a little bit of that to iron out. And I think it's quite interesting to see him in a more England are better than Dortmund. Dortmund are having a kind of a transitional moment for now. And yes, I've seen that on the board. But when you put him alongside players who are at a different stage of his career and who are perhaps a stronger team and with kind of stronger structures, you see him operate within a sort of a tighter framework, and you see just how good the player can be, yeah. Which is really interesting.
Yeah, okay. Another thing that stands in England's stead, I suppose, in this tournament is they've got a pretty decent number of wide attackers to choose from. Saka got the nod to start this game, which seems clearly it was a good decision. One of the sort of more amusing moments of the game was within seconds of him being substituted, Marcus Rashford scored from his position, an almost identical goal to Saka's second.
Yeah.
You wondered, would that have been the hat-trick moment? But why do you think Saka got the nod in this game over Rashford and Foden? And what is it about him that makes him so good?
I wonder what it is. Southgate seems to really like Saka. I really like Saka. He seems less... not flamboyant, but like Foden's very tricky and technical and does lots of bits and pieces here and there.
Is he a bit more flexible?
I don't know if it's that. I think he's got more kind of drive to him. I think he tends to take things and make things happen with the ball. Mm. Whereas maybe Foden dances around in between things, Saka actively goes at them. Maybe there's something to do with that.
Rashford's got a bit more of the different 1-2 about him as well. Like Rashford seems to be very direct to goal. Yeah. Obviously brilliant at carrying the ball. Saka seems to be somewhere between the two.
And the defensive part of his game as well is really strong. So it could be that you've got a lot of defensive cover. I mean, we know he can play at different positions, so he can cover for everyone. And want those rotations, it's really good. I think he's a really excellent footballer and a good person to have on the pitch. He's got a good mentality with it. It plays like someone who's much older than he actually is. Another options they've got, I mean, Grealish tends to play off the left. Rashford can play on that side as well. So, yeah, good options going on there. And Sterling can play that wing if they want. But I think they have a really good team. And I was just really pleased to see them actually play semi-decent football and not try and just work their way to a 1-0 off a penalty kind of win.
They can be a bit sort of horseshoe of doom. In this kind of situation, like especially against deep line defenses,
anyone can in that situation,
and that's what I worried about ahead of this game. I think we'll get to points of bad predictions later, but I didn't see more than a goal in this, or you know, I could easily have seen a 0-0 too. So it's really nice to see the what's the right word? Probably the intent and the understanding of what was necessary in the situation, and the commitment to playing forward football and decisive, snappy passing. It was really great.
Yeah, the way they managed the game is interesting because I think the first goal is open play. It's really hard to do. But I also think we'll talk about this now, is that Iran were not anywhere near as good as what I've seen them when I was doing research for this.
Yeah,
but
we expected more, didn't we? I mean, more. On that note, you think presumably that's just a case of like the surrounding issues getting to the players.
You think so? I mean, and Kerosh talked after the game. He said that it's too much pressure for his young lads or something like that. I don't know, I'm paraphrasing him, but he's talking about how, I mean, that's an awful lot of weight to carry, you know, the effect it might have on yourself, your career, your family, all sorts of things that are very complicated to deal with.
It's emotionally overwhelming.
Perhaps, yeah. And then there are tactical reasons. They were far too deep too early. Yeah. And I think the plan for Iran was that they would sit deep, really frustrate England like teams have done in the past. It's been easy to do in previous tournaments, and sit off them and hope to get a chance they can take. And they nearly got one because Bellingham got caught in the ball right in front of his box. That could easily have been a turnover, and then they lock it down. England get frustrated, get wound up, and they can't score because there's no space between the lines that we're talking about. But that's too early, too deep too early. I think they need to give themselves more space between the goalkeeper and the defence. The defensive line should be higher. And you saw it. As soon as they put pressure on England, when they're passing out from the back, they're not as good as they... Like, they looked really amazing in this game. But I think if you put pressure on particularly Maguire and Stones and Rice in those situations, they're not always going to be able to play their way out of it, and you can catch them. Mm. And that's what they did in the second half when they pushed up, and Iran just played more of a front-pressing three. I can't really work out the system. I even done a video on it, but I can't work out if it changed to a four at the back. I think it's more of a five. It changed a lot, depending on where they were. But put pressure on them higher up the pitch, and you get a bit more reward out of it.
Well, we'll talk about the USA in a minute, but in the first half, we saw a very technically proficient and aggressive team. You would wonder if they'll give England some issues. On England, before we move on, Seb, there was, as we said yesterday, there's a bit of discussion around them before the tournament. I personally think people do Southgate down a little bit. I think he knows how to manage a tournament, and I think also he tends to get the balance in international football better than people give him credit for most of the time. I'm perfectly happy to be wrong, but I think the expectation before the tournament started, I'm not happy to be wrong, was that England weren't going to perform that well. It's hard to take too many, I don't want to say learnings, but this is the only word in my head from this, given the context. How far do you think England will go?
No, well, I don't think my opinion has changed. I think once you get to the quarterfinal, it's going to be extremely difficult given how the draw is going to unravel.
Yeah.
But then I think the reality of it is when you win your first game, you're in a very, very strong position in the group. And I don't have a problem so much with the criticism of Southgate in the last few weeks and months, because they were rubbish in the Nations League. They were really, really awful. Mm. Those Hungary games were as bad as England have been in a
decade.
They lost
4-0, didn't they?
Lost 4-0 at home to
Hungary. Weren't they bad before the Euros as well, though?
Did they do this on purpose to lower the expectations? I feel like the Euros was a case study in what gets you through a tournament, which is conservative football, defensive resilience, and scoring goals at the right moment. I mean, there's pretty universal currency in football, I understand, but Southgate's pretty good at that. But because the weight of England's talent is at the top of the pitch, the perception is of caution being kind of counterintuitive and counterproductive, because you've got Harry Kane coming to the peak of his career, Raheem Sterling, Bukayo Saka, Jack Grealish, Phil Foden, and you think, why are we playing with such caution when it's that? And so that's a pretty difficult thing to for him to get around. But this was, hey, it's a great start. There's no point in being negative. This was, as I said at the time when we were watching, it's as good a first game as I've seen England play in a tournament, I think, in my lifetime. It's not saying that, that's just my opinion.
Yeah.
England start tournaments slowly. They play cautiously. They attract bad headlines after their first game. And generally speaking, when you get to the third group game, the qualification is still in the balance.
Yeah,
you have the horrible third game. And this is...
That's put this into context, right? Yeah. There was a stretch of 8 years where every group game was 0-0 or 1-0, and it was horrible.
Yeah, but think of some of the group games in... think of Euro 2000, for instance. Think of...
I was too young.
You were too young. Oh, God, I feel old. Think of the World Cup in 2014 or 2010 or...
Yeah.
You know, even parts of Russia, it wasn't that impressive. And this is as conclusive a performance as you could ask for.
True, true. Okay, here's a really good question from Nico Williams in the chat.
Nico, he's showered up.
He's just playing, he's busy.
Yeah, I assume he's messaging us from the dressing room and or...
He's a really committed
TIFO
fan.
It's not him. But Nico Williams asks, who has a better chance against England? Is it Wales or USA?
I don't know. I think they've two different things. We saw two different sides to Wales. I think it'd be interesting to see Kiefer Moore, who will probably start against England, I think, against Maguire. I wonder if England will change his shape to match Wales.
I think they go to a back
because they play two forwards. It depends. There's loads of variables that could be there. I mean, they might set up in a shape where they can change with three if they want to, but they will need to be aware of how Wales build. And Wales have a lot of depth between their centre backs and their forwards, and they make the pitch really big, whereas England were quite close together in this game, which generally they don't do. They tend to be quite spread out. And USA were clever with some of the things they did, but they're good in different ways.
Well, Happy Snacky helpfully points out in the chat that the chances are, if general expectations of these groups play out, that England will meet France in the quarterfinals, or could meet France.
That's a shocker.
So there you go. How exciting and fun for everyone.
Yes.
Are we all done with England and Iran for now?
I think so. I think also it is worth saying that once you, the anthem situation, if your emotional energy is going towards something like that, it then becomes incredibly difficult to play a World Cup match in front of a global audience. Also, remember that the collision between the goalkeeper, who sadly had to go off, and the centre half, that's got to be pretty unsettling. That was as nasty a collision as I've seen in quite some time. And they kept showing replays of it, which is most unwelcome. But it
25
was,
minutes added time in that game, which we're going to come back and...
You see someone like that happen to two of your teammates, I think that's quite difficult to cope with.
Yeah. Okay, well, let us have a break now.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone?
Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Oh, what a delightful break. We all enjoyed that one.
Should we tell everyone why John's not here?
Oh, because he's not here every other day. That's why.
I thought you'd do a bit.
No, yeah. I'm not into that bit. Don't like it.
Yeah, I remember you don't like it.
Makes me feel sad.
Back about, you know,
John and I are close friends.
You are close
friends. Of course I'm going to say that.
Yeah.
If John was here, he maybe would say something different.
We need to wait for John to come back to clarify that, to just, you know, to testify as to whether you are good friends, how he feels about the events of the last couple of days.
Sadly, I don't know anything behind the scenes. I can't say anything.
Yeah, it's not fair that
you can't take these bits back when they're live.
No, we
I know we're all comfortable in front of an audience now, but let's remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you've done your serious eyes. You've done your serious eyes. Okay.
It's because the fun's pointed at me and I'm not used to
when that. When the fun stops, continue to wind up
the double down.
That was all in the break, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Let's restart. Ah, what a break that was. Mm. I really enjoyed that one. USA 1, nil Wales. Let us discuss this game, because the USA, probably the better team in the first half, weren't they, JJ? Very impressive. Why were they so good?
They were miles better in the first half. I think they came in so it's weird. In the national anthems, it looked very much like Wales were the team really raring to go and USA were not. But what you saw instead in this game was just a lot of energy from USA, who were going to tackles really, really quickly as well. And there's something about the way that...
I said 1-0. I'm so sorry. I forgot to update it. It's 1-1.
That was 1-1.
Yeah. I wrote this bit of the plan when it was 1-0.
The chat has taken that really well.
Very bad.
Yes.
Sorry, everyone in the chat. Yeah, I wrote that when it was 1-0. So technically I was right then, but I am wrong now. 50-50.
Should we start that again then?
Yes.
Yes.
USA won 1 Wales, JJ. USA were probably the better team in the first half, weren't they? Why were they so good?
Let's start again.
Day two.
USA won 1 Wales. The USA, probably the better team in the first half, JJ. Why were they so good?
I think there's a few tactical reasons and a lot of character reasons as well. They seemed really up for it, USA. They were going for tackles very quickly and aggressively, and Wales did not like it. So the team shape, I'm not sure how much the team shape kind of helped, but basically Bale hardly got the ball, and Wales's problem is that they had a lot of depth between the three centre-backs and the boys who were high up the pitch. And what USA were doing, were pressing with like a front three. So they had this front three of Timothy Weah, Josh Sargent and Christian Pulisic. Then they had a three of McKenny, Adams and Musa behind them here, and the fullbacks, who are meant to be the most important part of the team, obviously, at fullback positions. And basically, the Wales front three, or Wilson was more in line with the midfield, actually, it was more like this. They just couldn't get the forwards into the game. James wasn't making runs into channels like he was supposed to. Bales didn't do anything. And then what you had was that USA were able to get the ball through to the wide areas by doubling up. So they'd have maybe Pulisic would pull out wide with McKenny, and you'd have Anthony Robertson would be slightly further back, but they'd have loads of double ups on the wide areas. So the ball would always be, they always be able to play it, and they were able to drag Wales out of position. And then Wales couldn't keep it. So they had so much depth between them that when they hit the ball up to the top, it just came straight back to them. And USA were combining really well, lots of rotations that you get McKenny and Pulisic. Pulisic would be coming inside the pitch. And the goal was a really clever, really cleverly worked, where they were slightly deeper, pushing right much deeper. I'm playing with a board if you're listening to this on the podcast. Do come and watch the live streams. And so what they managed to do, because Weah scores the goal, Timothy Weah, son of George, he manages to score the goal. But they basically push the ball forward and then follow it in. So someone will drop, which will drag a player with them. I think we'll probably push the midfield a bit further up like this. So they play the ball forward quickly, and then someone will drop in. So Pulisic might drop. That drags maybe a wing back or a centre back out with him. And then maybe that goes to Sargent. And then as he does that, someone else will come forward, which maybe drags someone else to try and start dealing with him. And that leaves space in behind for someone else to get in. So there's lots of rotations and movement. But basically the right winger for USA scores the goal in the centre forward's position with Pulisic running across him. So lots of clever movement and lots of rotations, but it was about the energy and the attacking impetus that they had, I think, really pushing forward.
What were you so impressed with in the first half, Seb?
The technical level. So in previous tournaments, I feel like the USA has emerged in a kind of a state of sort of existential crisis where they're worried about partially worried about their own performance, partially worried about how they're perceived. Yeah. I think also because that describes a pretty negative attitude towards US soccer from outside. Mm-hmm. And this time I remember thinking, and I hope this doesn't sound patronizing because it's not how I intend it to be. It was just, this is just a good side. This is just a good side full of good players who are sure of themselves. And I think part of that comes from, it's not a coincidence that they're playing at a high level. And some of the individual players here have established themselves and their own reputation in Europe. MLS has risen, the standard of MLS has risen exponentially over the last decade, definitely. But it's still beneficial to have these players in crucial spots across Europe. And I just thought, I was a little bit surprised too, because I looked at players like Sergino Dest, who hasn't played a lot of football, played to a really high level. I thought Josh Sargent hasn't had the best time at Norwich, a bit easier in the championship, of course, and that makes a difference. But then, and also Christian Pulisic is, his Chelsea career is a little nebulous. I mean, I'm not sure where it's headed at this point. But you saw them all at their very, very best for 45 minutes. I mean, obviously, I'm going to talk about the Welsh comeback after half time. But yeah, just a strong side. And I remember thinking at half time, I'm not looking forward to England playing this side. That's probably the first time, and this might be English arrogance, I'm sure it is, but it's probably the first time it's probably the first time I thought that about the US in the tournament. Not that you take them lightly, but you think, I think England, an England side playing well can cope with this team and, can match up really well with them. Whereas this side, buzzing around with energy, JJ's talked about some of the rotations and some of the combinations in high areas. England defense is going to struggle with that if they replicate what they did in the first 45 minutes.
I think that's true. Before we talk about the second half, I just want to talk about the growth of the sport in the States. Mm-hmm. We either have a video coming out about that or it has already come out. But there's some interesting stuff in that. And I think the reason I bring that up is because, you described this team as like a good team that fits where they are now. Presumably they're just going to get better, aren't they?
You'd think so. So I don't want to steal the video's thunder because it is yet to come out, but it's a great sport in the US and for a variety of different reasons. Obviously the percentage of the Hispanic population who consider themselves fans of the game, that element within the US population is growing faster than any other part of the US population. Also, and I spoke to the Athletic's Paul Tenorio for this, he talked about how dramatically improved the presentation availability of soccer is in America. So that includes things like, your choice of Premier League games, the broadcasting standard of them. And it's kind of night and day compared to certainly what Paul was used to as a, when he was growing up, when he was sort of a teenager in the 90s and he would have to make do with a couple of Champions League games a week. And then he told me that he was a big Francesco Totti fan growing up. And his access to Serie A came through pay-per-view games that he'd have to spend $20 on. And so all of these factors, and there's many more that I haven't covered and that, the video will do a good job of explaining. But yeah, you could say that it's the fastest growing team sport in the US, and the quality seems to get higher every World Cup that they appear in. I know they missed out in 2018, but you know what I'm saying? It's just, it's no longer... I think that's the best way of putting it. The US player is no longer a novelty in Europe. Like, you're just a good footballer. I felt like Landon Donovan was a very good footballer, but I think people said, before that, before they appreciated his goal scoring and his teamwork and his tremendous work rate, they say, but he's American. And that was terribly unfair. And now, there's a little bit of that, but now you just assess these players on their merits fairly. And that's really, really important. And that's kind of a real, real symptom of change, I think, over the last few decades.
Okay. Well, listen, at halftime in this game, JJ, Dan James came off.
Yes.
And Kiefer Moore came on. And that's a sort of small and fast man off on for a very large man.
A big, nasty man.
That changed
the
game.
He's a big lad. It did. Kiefer Moore coming on did definitely change the game. And there's a couple of things that apart from Moore coming on that made a big difference. So he was obviously a huge difference, literally huge, because he's massive. And so he was able to be at the top here, so you could put the ball into him. And he's very good at just holding it, shielding it, being able to block off defenders.
Yeah.
So then he could hold it here, and then he could get to bring players into play. So you could bring Ramsey in, you could bring Carl Roberts into play. That's some of the things he could do. But he was also moving the channels much better than what Dan James was doing. So then he could be a wide kind of guy that could keep the ball, a wide guy. So he can keep the ball in wide areas to, again, allow teammates to come in and combine with him and take Wales up the pitch because they couldn't get out of their own half.
Can I ask a question then?
Yes.
It's like... It seems kind of obvious that he would do that. Maybe not the second part, but that he's bigger and taller and can hold the ball up, right? That seems like an obvious thing that a casual, not, I'm not denigrating your analysis, but that seems like an obvious thing that a casual fan could pick up. Why didn't he start? I don't understand.
Well, I think the reason they didn't start is because when you played Dan James, so you know the way the USA are going to play. Both teams basically had done research on each other and knew exactly how they're going to play. And I can show you what the USA do in a second. But when you have Bale, James, and say, what was the other one? Wilson, put him up top. Maybe, and you've got a midfield two, it means that you've got these fast lads who can, this is the wrong way around actually, put him there like this. So these can all get in behind a high line because USA like to play aggressive football and they like to play quite a high line. They like to push into the other half so they can then combine with this narrow front three. See how this looks? Well, on the board I've got the front, the 3-4, the 4-3-3 looks very narrow, and it was for a lot of the time. But then if you play a high line, it means that you have players like Dan James or Gareth Bale or Harry Wilson who can run in behind. And so you've got an option when the USA squeeze you, you can then recoil and spring out the back.
Yeah.
Then you've got pace. You've also got pace from players like Nico Williams and Carl Roberts. And then maybe Ramsey joins in at certain times, box to box to join in. But what USA were doing as well as that, rather than having Kiefer Moore there. So this, it's about chance creation, right? Mm-hmm. It's still in Wales, actually. So it's about chance creation and how you want to create your chances, probably by springing attacks against a back line which isn't very fast. Tim Ream and Walker Zimmerman, that's his name, isn't it? They're not especially rapid. And you saw the huge error Zimmerman made in the box to take down Bale, right? So you know you can probably play against these guys. You also know for sure that Dest and Robinson are going to get forward. They're going to do that because they are, well, they were underlapping quite a lot as well, but you know that's what's going to happen. So look where you get your space. Loads of space in here to be able to attack against the high lines. It makes perfect sense. Whereas for Wales, what USA knew they would do is need their width from these wing backs. So Nico Williams and Carl Roberts getting forward, but they were kept real pinned back all the time by this narrow front three. And Pulisic would look, and Weah would want to get in behind the space left by these fullbacks or wingbacks getting up the pitch, either side of the centre backs. So what they did in the second half was they kept Amtadou is more of the kind of like anchor, we'll call him, like a six, more close to these guys here. And then that meant that they could play basically Williams on one side, Roberts on the other, and then you could have Ramsey and Wilson and get rid of James. You can go away and put Moore in, and then you've basically got that two with the two wide players next to them in a row. So you've got a different change of shape, which then forces USA to come back a little bit more to try and defend, which then changes the way they play.
Okay. Lovely comment in the chat here. I can't remember who. Oh, it was William Tarantula who wrote this down. William Tarantula. Kiefer Moore is only ever referred to with his whole name. It's just the way things are meant to be.
Yeah.
Can you think of another footballer that's only ever mentioned? I mean, people would always say Roy Keane, right?
John
no
McGinn.
One ever says Keane. Do people say Keane?
There used to be a player for Cardiff City called Don Cowie, who was always just called Don Cowie.
Don Cowie.
Also, when you played for England, Wayne Rooney.
Dan James.
No, people said Rooney.
No. When it was England and when it was World Cup.
Rooney.
Clive Tilsley always used to say Wayne Rooney. Always.
He would also go, Rooney!
That's a good one.
That was really nice.
I've done a lot of
Do that again.
Do you think that was good?
Yeah, do it one more time.
I really like that.
Oh, if I do it now, it won't be as good. Rooney!
That's pretty good. That was...
I like doing
it. Might have been better the second time.
Well, thanks very much.
Let's try more of those later. Now, listen, we've got a few more bits to get through before the end of the live stream, and we've given ourselves a hard out of an hour, guys. So we've really got to rush now.
Okay.
The final question on the USA Wales game, not specific to the USA Wales game, but there was 25 minutes added in the England game. We talked about that before. There was 9 minutes at the end of USA Wales. I couldn't find the number that was added to Netherlands Senegal, but there was quite a lot in the first half, I remember. It does feel like there's quite a lot of added time. Of course, with the England-Iran game, the poor Iranian goalkeeper, whose nose seemed to be like three or four times the size it was by the time he left. We could have a conversation about concussion and substitutions, by the way, also. Maybe we should come back and do that. It seems like there's an awful lot of added time, Seb. What's going on, do you think?
Well, what I think, and this is just theory, Joe.
This is one of your opinions.
Yeah, just a big opinion. So before the tournament, there was a little bit of a conversation about time wasting and how time-wasting was going to suffer a bit of a crackdown during this World Cup. Simultaneously, there is also a conversation occurring about how the clock is managed in the future and a potential rule change to avoid teams who are winning by narrow margins, milking the clock and running it down with, you know, cramps and substitutions and delays over throw-ins. I think it's about creating a certain context around the game, certainly about sort of almost not quite sending a message, but illustrating just how much time fans should be compensated with because of, you know, low ball in play statistics and things like that. So I think that's where we're headed, and I think it's going to continue. I mean, obviously, the England-Iran game needed that amount of stoppage time in the first half.
Yeah.
Bit weird to see so much in every other game we've seen. It seems intentional. It's too much of a coincidence otherwise.
It's kind of working on me. I think I've sort of thought before, you know, the temptation as a fan is to go, well, hold on, there were all these stoppages. There are only 4 minutes when it should be 11. But now I have 11. I don't want it.
I think it's because we've got used to being compensated with 3 or 4 minutes when we should have actually, by letter of law, had maybe 10. And now this is part of the redressing of that imbalance. So keep an eye on it, I think.
Andy Thomas in the chat says, the US broadcast said many times that the refs were instructed to pause for every single stoppage time. The point about time wasting is exactly right.
Could very well be right. I don't know.
Interesting.
It's just my opinion.
Okay. And concussion sub, the Iranian goalkeeper, whose name I've forgotten, sorry. He was down for about 10 minutes, which is why there was so much added time in the first half. He sort of insisted that he was okay, you know, fair enough, but then came off a minute later. And listen, of course, you understand that from a player's perspective, they would want to continue playing, which is why the responsibility presumably is not theirs to make that decision. Somebody else needs to make that decision with their health and safety first and foremost in mind. And given that, I mean, our broadcast suggested that he was then taken off as a, I think it said like possible concussion substitution. It wasn't clear whether it was or not. What do you think has happened there?
I have no idea. I can't come up with a defense for it. Obviously, you've said already, it cannot be the player's decision to say, I'm fine, because you need to evaluate a player. You need to evaluate a player. I'm no doctor, clearly, but we are well beyond the point in the game where, in any professional sport, where we're asking, right, do you feel like playing on? Yes. Okay then.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's what happened in this instance. I just found it very alarming that he suffered a very serious injury, was allowed to continue, and within, I'm not quite sure how long it took, but maybe a minute or two, he was very clearly not able to continue, and he was lying on the floor. So I have no idea what happened there, but I'm not in a hurry to see it happen again.
Here's a good question from Marcus Ambler. Has the heat made a visible difference to the performance of the teams, or has it been well managed, do you think?
We've only really seen them in the cool games. I think we'll see tomorrow morning when Argentina play Saudi Arabia.
Because 10 a.m. is 1 p.m. in Qatar, right? Or our time is 1 p.m. That's the 1 p.m. game local time.
Yeah, I think a lot of teams are picking and choosing when to go and press. No one's played a ridiculous high press. There were moments when England were counter-pressing a little bit to try and win it back, but again, they were later in the day, so it's a bit cooler.
Ecuador relaxed pretty quickly after 2-0 last night. Didn't they?
Yeah. Was it Ali McCoy said on comms for the Netherlands game that it was rather mild. It was nowhere near as hot as he thought it was going to be. So which is good.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's have another break, and then when we come back, we will discuss Netherlands Senegal.
Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army Knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it. Tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Visit DirecTV.com. Requires high-speed internet-connected Gemini device and separate paid subscription to watch Netflix on DirecTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
Netherlands 2. Nil Senegal. This was quite a fun game, actually, wasn't it? JJ, the Netherlands missed the 2018 World Cup, of course. The last time we saw them was in 2014. I think one of my favorite international games of all time, two of them came in the same tournament. And I'm speaking, of course, of the, was it 5-0? The victory over Spain in 5-1. The group stages. 5-1. With that Robin van Persie diving sort of goose header, you know, in the first...
Another one.
First minute. That was what a goal. I love that goal. Anyway, 4 years earlier, of course, 2010, they reached the final. What are we seeing from the Dutch now?
What we're seeing from the Dutch is, they're a Louis van Gaal team.
Yes.
Does he say his name?
Yes.
That's how he says it.
That's well, you just said it, yeah.
Yeah.
What would you normally say? Gaal?
One of the two.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're very functional. They're very well organized. They're playing with a back five system, which is actually more of a four, because really what happens generally is that the right wing back moves up. Denzel Dumfries is his name. And he tends to be more of like a chaotic forward. He gets into the box quite a lot. And then Blind tucks over with Ake and Van Dijk, and De Ligt goes to like right back, pushes into midfield a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. But they're decent enough, and they've got good forwards, good players all around. Gakpo scored the first goal, and Davy Klassen, who I confused with Kasper Dolberg of Denmark in my tactical previews, scored the second. But what you had was when Janssen went off and Memphis came on, they were suddenly, I thought, a lot better because the combinations were working a lot better in the final third.
Yeah.
So Memphis was dropping quite a lot, and it was dragging players out of position, which allowed someone to get in behind. I can't remember who came off for Bergwijn, or on for Bergwijn, is what I'm trying to say. But yeah, I think they're functional, and they...
David Klassen, though.
Was it Klassen? I don't know.
I think so.
The one thing I did notice about them is really good is De Jong is brilliant between the boxes. Mm. So De Jong was just carrying the ball all the way up to the opposition box sometimes, but he found himself round about outside the box and shoot just to the finish. He's 1v1 with the keeper, then took two when he touches, didn't trust his left foot. Kind of classic, brilliant player between boxes, but not in them.
Mm.
There's a couple of errors defensively made as well. I love that guy though, Frankie De Jong.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
He is very good, isn't he?
Yeah, I went to see, I think I said this before, but I went to see Ajax play a few seasons ago, and it was him and De Ligt and all the big lads basically before they got sold.
Yeah.
It was brilliant, and De Jong really stood out. De Ligt stood out as well.
He's extraordinarily good looking as well.
De Jong.
We were in the pub for this game, and we saw Ryan Hunt of the Stadio podcast. I leant over to Ryan. I said, "This has a shout for the best looking game so far." Would you agree with my analysis, Seb?
Yeah, it's a strong analysis. I mean, lots of handsome people playing football at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Fantastic.
It's a kind of odd question to ask,
yeah,
isn't it?
Sure.
Let me ask you a different one instead. Yes. Aliou Cisse, I've spit all over my face.
Yeah.
Aliou Cisse and Louis van Gaal, both very experienced tournament managers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you think we saw that reflected tactically in the game? Was it a bit of, you know, it was kind of, it felt not stalematey, but it felt kind of evenly balanced for periods of the game, didn't it?
Yeah, I know they lost, but I thought Senegal gave a really mature performance in that they played quite well around the absence of Sadio Mane. Obviously, they're African champions. It's what you expect. I think they were runners-up also in 2019. So Aliou Cisse, he's been manager for 7 years now, so he's a very experienced international manager. And I felt like, you know, their game plan was good. They defended pretty well. They kept the ball really well. I really liked that when they broke, typically through Ismail Assar, when there wasn't an option, they consolidated and retained possession and built around the Dutch box. And the goalkeeper, the 6'8" goalkeeper, who I think must be the tallest in the competition. Can't think of any 7-foot goalkeeper.
The Netherlands goalkeeper.
Yeah, he's...
Where did he come from, by the way?
Heerenveen. He made his international debut.
Yeah, today.
Today in the World Cup, which is pretty... it's a bit of a vote of confidence.
He made some great saves.
He did. He was pretty impressive. Didn't have any bad moments. He looked good. Justified his selection. Well done. Because that's pretty nerve-wracking, I'd have thought, as a goalkeeper to be in that. But I thought Senegal were good. And I just Edouard Mendy didn't have the best game. But I found myself thinking...
could they have done more with Sadio Mane?
Yeah, I feel they might have done. Because Dia, who played as a kind of... not quite as a nine, but in that role... he's never been a prolific player. He's now at Salernitana in Italy, but he had some time at Villarreal. He scored some nice goals. Didn't score goals in high volume. And I think you can see good footballer, not necessarily a lethal finisher. But Mane's world-class player, he would have made them better, no doubt. And he was a big part of winning AFCON for them. So
Sar was decent.
I thought Sar was great. I remember saying to the guys in the office, I can't believe he's still playing the championship. He's such a good player.
Yeah, he's a good player. Because Mane tends to play off the left, but it comes in behind like an extra 9 or a 10 in Senegal. The things I watched when I was doing all the research. But, and Dia is like their poacher. Diatta, I don't know much about. So yeah, but then Idrissa Gueye coming behind him is playing not quite a 10, not quite an 8, somewhere in between.
Certainly more advanced than he
is. But
it
helps you
win
the ball back in midfield. And yeah, because Holland are playing that like 5-2-1-2 basically is the shape, that kind of helps with what they've got there.
Yeah.
When you said to Seb, that was a bit stale, matey, then I heard it like you were a pirate.
It's like he was offering me some cheese that had gone out.
No, no, it's like you're saying
stale, matey.
Like like he's a pirate.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a bit matey. It wasn't a bit stale, matey.
Yeah.
Arr.
Well, you know, that sounds fun. I can't off the top of my head think of a joke that's okay to make, so I'll move on. one more question. Cody Gakpo played in this game, JJ, and scored a goal.
Yes.
It wasn't clear how much he knew about which direction it was going in, but it did. It had the quality of a goal which looked at once like an incredible header and also like a quite lucky goal. Hard to tell.
I think it was De Jong that had the cross as well for him. Yeah. I remember watching it and I was thinking they were taking too many touches and they're being too slow, because both teams were, I think they were quite worried about each other and they were very stalematey. And so they were keeping things... They were keeping things really quiet. Ahoy there. No, they were keeping mostly... It was a very 0-0 game, literally, for most of it, because they were kind of not wanting to commit too many people forward, not wanting to make a mistake, not commit, you know, basically leave space in behind. So when they got to that final section of the pitch and then De Jong was on the ball just outside the box, I really did think he was taking too many touches and they weren't going to be able to get in. And I was completely wrong, because the ball he picked was perfect for the run that Gakpo was making from out to in.
Yeah.
And then Gakpo put his head out the way. He was looking the wrong way, but it's because he knows that Mendy's going to come in and punch his head in a different dimension if he doesn't do it.
Well, this is interesting, because Swords in the chat asks, on a scale of 1 to goose, how much of a goose header was this particular goal? And it's not in the same way that Robin van Persie's head... No, because Robin van Persie dove forward and then sort of arced backwards. But Cody Gakpo was kind of going backwards. He still arced backwards, so there's a bit of goose in there.
His movement was much like a goose flying from the place that he would normally reside to a more exciting goal... filled place.
Filled with
golden
goose
eggs.
Goose food. Yes, golden eggs.
Golden eggs.
Yes, yes. Anyway, the game between Ecuador and Senegal now feels very important.
Sure does.
Is that fair? What do we expect from that one?
I'm not sure, because I feel
like...
Is it
geese?
Maybe some geese, but also good football, because I think we saw Ecuador play 40 minutes of good football and then realised the game was won and then kind of dropped down a few gears for the sake of preserving some energy. And I feel good about Senegal, but not quite sure where the goal is going to come from. So,
no.
Tight game.
Okay.
Be a low scoring affair on the old points of bad predictions, I would have thought.
Well, we're going to come to points of bad very shortly. Yeah. But before we do, Seb, the stadium attendance for this game was announced as 41,721, which you've pointed out here in the plan is 1,721 over capacity. But the stadium very clearly had many empty seats. What do you think's happened there?
I don't know.
Neither do I. I don't know either.
What I will say...
More geese.
Ghosts.
Sometimes this happens in the Premier League. Sometimes when you're sat in the press box, a press officer will walk around with a little piece of paper saying, giving you a figure of tickets sold rather than people in the stadium. So it's not that I haven't seen this happen before. Because sometimes you go to a stadium and you'd be like, 60,000 people, and you can see 15,000 empty seats in a stadium which only holds 55,000 people.
But so the tickets were sold, but the people didn't show.
I have no idea whether that's what happened here. It's just, a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of different bits of information about this, so I'm not quite sure what to trust yet.
Let me just tell you, though, on a separate and very safe note, when I buy a ticket to something, and I've done this numerous times in the past, sometimes... I don't go. And it's the best night ever.
Yeah.
When you buy a gig ticket, and I don't encourage people to do this because it's a terrible thing to do. And not only is it bad for you, it's bad for the event if you're not going. But if you don't go, if you bail on it, you have an amazing time at home. You have like a rewarding victory of being at home when you weren't supposed to. And it feels, even though you do the same things you would have done if you didn't have the ticket at all, it feels different. Do you know what I'm saying? Do you have this?
It's like a snow day.
It's like a snow day. Yeah.
The chat has described this as resting attendance.
Right.
Which is quite good.
Nice. I like the idea that people have gone dressed as chairs. And that's why it looks empty. It's not. It's full. People dressed as chairs.
People dressed as thousands of people dressed as chairs. Anyway, let's do points are bad now, because we've had an interesting day with points are bad. I can tell you that of the various predictions that we made yesterday, the only really... No, there's a couple of noteworthy ones we can include here. The first was my prediction of 5-0 England, which I have to say I made entirely in jest and wasn't expecting the result to be 6-2 at all. But that really helped me, because as I lost many points throughout the rest of the day, or gained many points, I should say, that balanced me out. Other shouts here, I believe that for Senegal-Netherlands, JJ got the exact correct scoreline. Congratulations to you. And also other things, that's about it.
Who got the correct scoreline? Was it me?
You got the correct scoreline, exact correct scoreline. And JJ, for today?
Yeah.
You only added 7 points. We all added a lot of points today, but you only added 7. So you had the best score of the day, which means, of course, that you go last in the predictions. I added 8, and 7, John added 9. So the overall scores as it stands currently are, in first place is JJ on 8. Yes? In second place is John on 9. Yes? As it should be. And in joint third place is you and me on 10. Seb.
Oh, you're going to have to go first with your prediction.
Did you do a dab?
He did.
I did a dab. Yeah. I did a dab.
He's done it 4 times today and it's got funnier every time.
Actually, Seb, it's you and John that go first because you did the worst of the day. So first what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what John's predictions for the games tomorrow are. Now, for Argentina, I should have done this earlier because now I'm typing as well, Saudi Arabia. God, this is dreadful. John has predicted a 3-0 victory to Argentina, yes? And for the second game, which is Mexico versus Poland, John has predicted 0-2. This is terrible. And for the third game, which is Denmark versus Tunisia, people are just watching me type into my computer. John has predicted...
Do some background music or something.
Oh, John's predicted 3-0 Denmark for that one, yeah? Mm. And for the fourth game, it is France versus Australia. John has predicted 3-0 France. So those are John's predictions. Seb, I come to you now. Argentina, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. What do you think? I mean, could be a big scoreline, couldn't it?
I'm going to take 6-0 Argentina.
You go for a whack? That's
yes,
a very
I am.
Risky
I'm going
play.
Bold on that one.
Okay.
6-0 Argentina for that one. Denmark, Tunisia, 3-0 Denmark.
Denmark, Tunisia was the third one, but that's fine. We'll go to 3, and you can't have that because John's already had it. You really need to pay better attention.
You made that segment quite boring.
I know. I don't know.
I'm going to say 2-0 Denmark then. Fine.
2-0 Denmark. Yes, indeed. Yeah, okay. We've got Mexico, Poland.
0-2 Poland.
0-2. Well, again, that's exactly what John said.
I was not listening to you at all. Sure. I'm going to say 0-1 Poland.
Well, this is an exciting segment. And France, Australia.
I'm going
don't to say 3-0.
Say 1-1.
Oh, 1-1. France, Australia. That's quite a big show.
I've heard some, you
it's
know,
crazy.
The strange things in the French camp. So
okay, you know, fine. Well, for myself, I'm going to predict a healthy 4-0 victory to Argentina against Saudi Arabia. Mexico, Poland. I'm going for Mexico here. I think Robert Lewandowski's going to score, but I'm going to go for Mexico 2-1. How about that?
Big problem with goals for Mexico. So,
is there?
Yeah.
Don't know anything about them. Denmark, Tunisia. I'm just going based off how I feel about the sound of the word.
Yeah.
And Denmark, Tunisia. Who doesn't like... I love Denmark.
Tunisia.
So let's say...
Full of goals.
1-0, because that's the result that hasn't been taken yet. And of course, France, Australia. 0-0. And JJ, let's bring this miserable section to a close and choose definitely to do it differently tomorrow.
Oh, yes.
Argentina versus the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia.
What did you say?
Well... Is that a joke?
No.
No, okay. 3-0, 4-0, and 6-0 are taken.
I think it's going to be hot tomorrow, so I'm going to say 2-0.
2-0? Yes. Oh, that's an interesting one. Okay. Yeah. And Mexico and Poland, what about the hotness there?
1-1.
1-1. Okay,
medium
fine.
Spice.
Yeah, medium spice. Denmark versus Tunisia. What's the heat decibels?
Heat decibels. I think that's
what's it called. The chili.
The Scargill.
The Scargill. Scoville. The Scargill. The Scoville. What about Denmark, Tunisia? Come now. We've had a 1-0, a 2-0, and a 3-0.
Oh, have you? Oh, yeah. that's unfortunate. 1-1.
1-1. Yay. And France versus Australia. We've had a 5-0, a 1-1. Oh, you're going for 5-0.
Yeah, okay, why not? Have a fun. Easy. Must live life on the fast lane.
JJ's got 2-1-1s tomorrow, which I think, if we remember correctly from last summer, is the way to win the game. So, yeah. And also, given that you went last, you shouldn't have been allowed those, but you did get them. I think you might start to create a bit of a gap here, a bit of distance at the front
well,
runner.
That's good.
Yeah. It's always nice to look behind you and see the rest of us. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's the end of this for now. But thank you to JJ Bull the Bullet.
Yes.
You won't be here tomorrow, will you? But we'll have Jonathan McKenzie in your place.
Yes, a much better tactician.
There we go. Sebastian Stafford-Bloor, thank you.
Thank you very much. Joe Devine.
You'll be here tomorrow.
I shall.
Yes. And thanks to the gang of Don, Jamie and Craig over there for all of their hard work. And that's all from me. Bye.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.